We'll be back here at the Spiritual Light Center. Beverly alluded to a long journey. Is that you? We're getting reverberation on that. Okay. Beverly alluded to a long journey, and so the story that I won't tell you the whole thing about because it's just too long is that about 3 months after I started ministerial school in 2007 or 2008, I got a call from the woman who was then the administrator here at the Spiritual Light Center, and she said, could you come and speak on Easter Sunday? And I was like, I don't know, could I? So I really started my speaking, my pulpit speaking, here in this community. And as Beverly likes to say, when I started, I was doing this, okay, most of the time because I was terrified of what was out there in front of me. So hopefully we'll be a little bit better and a little more polished this morning. So, as always, it's really wonderful to be here. It is like coming home. And I just want to acknowledge this community, these small communities, like Spiritual Light Center here in the mountains, are providing a huge resource for our communities, in that we truly are communities of equality and unconditional love. I think we live as deeply as those of us, which is all of us, as spiritual beings having this human experience, can live divine principle. And, you know, we're having this human experience, so obviously it's not a path of perfection yet, but we're headed in the right direction, and it just means so much. It means so much to me as a minister with a very small community as well, that we continue to do what we are doing. Someone said to me a couple of years ago, but your church isn't huge. And I'm like, you know what? The bottom line is if we touch one life, we've changed. We've changed the whole world. So I applaud all of you for being here, for suiting up and showing up today. I know and believe that any time we take care of ourselves on a spiritual level, we are taking care of and looking out for every other human being, every other species, everything that is on this planet, and maybe others too, but I don't have any direct experience with that, so we won't go there. So this morning we're going to talk about thought, and I loved the list of little things that someone, I don't know if it was Bill or Doug or Beverly, somebody put together this little thing on to learn how to think, and that first one by Margaret Mead. Because, you know, I said something at Open Door Center a couple of weeks ago to the effect of, we don't teach you what to think here. That's up to you. We teach you how to think so that you are thinking from a place of the uppermost level of creative capacity that we, again, as spiritual beings having a human experience, can muster. And that's huge. It changes your life. It changes my life. And folks, it changes lives all over the continent. And that's, again, that's really huge. I feel like we are at a crux in development on this planet. And if those of us who can hold the line in truth, consciousness, don't live it with every ounce of our being, the things we're going to see are not going to be pretty or fun for those who follow in our footsteps. So keep it up. You guys are awesome. I love you. But we do. That's what we do. We don't teach people what to think. We teach people how to go about thinking. And I'm going to put my glasses on. I've got lots of notes today, and I don't want to leave out anything that's, you know, really awesome or cool, so I'll remember that so that I'll have these in front of me. I don't know who said it. One of you might know, whether it was Louise Hay or Wayne Dyer, somebody akin to this New Thought Science of Mind teaching made the statement that if we change our thinking, we change our lives. And that has become the, you know, the mantra, the thing that goes out before this movement and tells people, you know, in six short words, who we are and what it is we are about. And I just believe that, you know, with all my heart, that that's true. I think we understand here that thought truly is the starting point of every new creative adventure. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Science of Mind, so, you know, hopefully I'm not redundant in sharing that Science of Mind was founded in the early 1900s by a man by the name of Ernest Holmes. Ernest was born in the late 1880s to a family that was Christian. His mother was adamant that her children would know the Bible and that they would grow up believing in a loving, perfectly fair, all across the board, beloved deity, beloved God. And I think that that is really a powerful thing. It's a powerful message that shines through the Science of Mind teaching. During his life, which ended in 1960, Ernest Holmes authored 63 books. The most prominent of those are two books by the same title, The Science of Mind Text. And so I'm going to be quoting some today from the second edition of that, which came out in 1938. In that book, Ernest tells us, to learn how to think is to learn how to live. He also tells us that trained thought is more powerful than untrained thought. So we understand as we step into this that thought is very prominent, a very significant component here in this teaching. What is thought? Try to define something as esoteric as that, right? Well, I went to the dictionary, and the result was kind of like if you took two pieces of bread and slapped them together with nothing in the middle and called it a sandwich. This definition ain't worth much, but I'll share it anyway. From the dictionary definition, thought is defined as the product or result of mental activity. Okay, whatever. To me, that's useless. Where I get a better understanding of it is if I take the idea of thought and I align that within concepts that are part of what we know today as quantum science. This is an area of science that tells us that everything, everywhere, is essentially energy. So that means the things that we think are solid, like your waistline or your chair, sorry folks, doo-doo-doo-doo, Twilight Zone time, they are not solid. They are energetic in nature. And how all those things, those whatever they are, quarks or particles or atoms or whatever, came together to become a chair or your waistline, you know, or the eyeglasses you need to see something with nowadays, I don't know. That piece I can't answer, okay? But essentially, science has gotten to the point where we understand that everything that is like 99% energy. So for the purposes of our conversation today, we're going to understand, we're going to establish that thought, too, is a form of energy. Essentially, we might look at it as being motorized energy or activated energy. It is propelled by something, probably our minds, because that's where thought issues from. Okay? And sometimes there's bigger things behind it. So we'll talk about that in a minute. As I was working on this, I found some ideas about some facts about thought that are not so fun. These come from a study that was put together in 2005 by the National Science Foundation, and it was published in an article. Each of us, every day, we have between 12,000 and 60,000 thoughts. That's a lot of thinking. Okay, that's channel that and light up New York, right? We could do that if we wanted to, right? Okay, and really, that's incredibly powerful when you think about it. There's a problem with all this, though. Anybody want to guess what percentage of those thoughts is negative? 80. And of those thoughts, all those sum total of thoughts that we each have, 95% of our thoughts are repetitive, meaning we thought them yesterday, this morning, last night, a week ago Sunday, blah, 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 blah. Now, most of us are from a time and an era when our music came to us on vinyl, and we took the arm of the record player and set it on the record to make the music play. Every time we did that, the little diamond head on that needle, okay, on that record player, on the arm, literally ran around a groove and made that groove infinitely, you know, greater. It got bigger and bigger and bigger. Every time we have a thought, especially a repetitive thought, think about what we're doing to the gray matter up here, okay? We're really changing things. We're driving those thoughts deeper and deeper and deeper. Can anyone tell me what the definition of a belief is? It's a thought that we have sunk over and over and over and over and over and over again. That's where our beliefs come from, okay? Yeah, so that's pretty significant. Let's see. What we can take from all of that then is that obviously we must think in several different arenas or domains. We can think consciously, and then we can think unconsciously or by default. And obviously, according to that study, a lot of our thinking that's going on is under the waterline. I like to use the analogy in teaching of an iceberg when we talk about thinking and consciousness and whether we're operating from a place that's really aware and awake and conscious versus maybe kind of running on default or automatic, okay? There's an iceberg in the Arctic Ocean that's so large they call it Ice Mountain. The estimates on Ice Mountain that only 10 or 20% of it is above the water line. That means 80 or 90% of it is below the water. If we take our thought, the whole realm of thought, conscious and unconscious, and apply it to that model, what we see, obviously, is that it's very similar to Ice Mountain in that about 20% of what we're doing is conscious, maybe positive, maybe well thought through. The rest of it, we're running beneath the water line there. And there's a lot of stuff under the water, just a whole lot of stuff. So we can't see that stuff. And those poor people that were riding on the Titanic, they didn't see it coming either, okay? The analogy that I think, or the parallel that I think is important to get here, is that we may be riding a planet that is heading toward a massive collision if we don't get our thinking, our awareness, our intent, and our power out there into consciousness. So we can use that concept there of an iceberg as a metaphor for all of this. Now, as we look at that, there's conscious thought. There's that part that's above the water. And I like to think that some of that is what we might refer to as designer thinking. You know, designer clothes, they're all drawn out and modeled and, you know, looked at from every angle. Well, that's what designer thinking is. Designer thinking essentially is thoughts that we have sculpted with our consciousness, with a clarity where we know that that thought we are producing, that we are sending out, is the highest thought that we can muster in that moment. Okay? So that's a designer thought. The rest of the time, we might be running, again, on default or on automatic. The piece that's important to recognize is that that stuff under the waterline is as potent and as powerful as the thoughts that we are thinking about, constructing purposefully, thoughtfully, with clarity. In Science of Mind, it is our belief, it is the teaching of our founder and our belief, that when we have a thought, it is acted upon. There is the belief that this entire universe is governed by universal laws. We could consider them spiritual in nature. And a couple of years ago, I had a person come into our congregation in Silva who was a professed atheist. And I had a really profound experience in that I realized and recognized this idea of a universal law, of a law that is applicable to everyone exactly in the same, to the same degree, with a complete consistency and fairness and applicability. I said it, okay? Yeah. That understanding can be used by someone who doesn't even believe in God. Okay? If you believe your thought is powerful and you believe that there are universal laws, you can use this teaching and have absolutely no spiritual, you know, engagement with it at all. So to me, that's kind of cool, because a lot of people today say, I'm not going back to church. I went somewhere and I had a bad experience, or, you know, I just don't see the relevance of it, or I work 5 days a week and I'm not getting up early on Sunday. You can get a grip, okay? And I don't blame them. You know, they're out there hoofing it, doing their thing. You know, I totally understand that. Maybe they've got kids or whatever. It's just not their cup of tea. But we understand that there is this universal law, and when we have a thought, it always responds with one answer. That answer is always yes. It's not going to make decisions for us. It's not like God's going to get in our face and go, but Barbara, did you really want to think that thought about that person who just cut in front of you and almost caused an accident? Okay? Did you really want to think that about that truck driver? Some poor dude got his 18-wheeler stuck. If you've ever come to Silva, this guy tried to come off Main Street onto Back Street about 10 cars in front of me, and he couldn't make the turn, and he was stuck. And I'm like, I ain't being late. Are we clear on this? We will be there on time. Are we clear on this? Let me find a back way out of this. And don't call him a name. Just bless him, okay? Because I wouldn't want to be in those shoes. Okay? I can't imagine getting an 18-wheeler stuck in a little place, okay? Ugh, okay? No fun. So we understand that every thought we have, this universal law is saying yes to it, okay? And regardless of whether or not we really believe that that is happening or believe in that universal law, it's happening anyway. Now, what makes a thought strong? What makes a thought powerful? Have you ever had a thought and like 10 minutes later, have you ever thought of a song and 10 minutes later the stupid thing comes on the radio? I'm like, okay, cool. You know, how does that happen, right? Well, it's kind of like the universe heard it. You know, maybe those catalysts that are behind some thoughts that cause them to manifest things faster, maybe those are things like intention or strong emotion, okay, or even a very deep-seated conviction, or, you know, just a knowing, okay. Sometimes we have this intuitive hit and bam, you know, 30 minutes later, 3 days later, 6 months later, it's in form. It happened, okay? Because there was something attached to that thought that motorized it, that activated it, that sent it out there in the universe. And when the universe got a hold of it, it said, not only did it say yes, but it was like, okay, cool, you're going to do this. Well, I'm going to bring these people in over here, and we're going to make that happen over here, and then this is going to happen here. And 3 years later, how did all that happen? Okay? It's just amazing. Things just showed up. We've all had that happen, right? Sometimes it's eerie. So, thought, again, is a starting point of every new creation. So we understand in all of this that we can bring into our experience pretty much anything that we desire to see made manifest, as long as we are thinking clearly and living in accordance, maintaining that thought line, that thought stream, and living in accordance with the outcome, the outpicturing of that thought and that belief. It's as if when we have a thought, literally a mold is developed in a subjective field, and that idea begins to literally fill in the pages. And another analogy is, have you ever been given, you know, a sheet of paper, okay, with a picture, just a black and white picture on it, and been told color in the lines, okay? What if somebody gave you a blank piece of paper with no lines at all, and they said, color in the lines? You would look at them like, there ain't no lines there, sweetie, okay? They'd be thinking, right, that's what's happening. You know, when we're not conscious of what we're constructing out there in manifest form, that's kind of what is happening. we're constructing with no mental equivalent, nothing behind it. So what if we don't know any of this? I grew up in a home where they didn't teach any of this. Anybody in here have that same experience? They didn't tell me anything about my thoughts growing up, okay? Ernest says that does not matter. Ignorance of this excuses no one from its effects, for we are dealing with law and not with whimsical theory. And he goes on to advise us of this. We should learn to control our thought processes. Thought should tend more and more toward an affirmative attitude of mind that is positive and stable. Merely to abstain from wrong thinking is not sufficient. There must be active right thinking. We must become actively constructive and happy in our thinking, not merely passively so. New and wholesome ideas of life, vitality, and hope must be accepted and incorporated into the substratum of our mental life. That's the area right below the waterline, right there, guys, okay? So that a more wholesome externalization may manifest in our bodily condition and our circumstances. Doesn't that sound like Ernest? For those of you who've read some Science of Mind, yeah, he's, if he could say it in five words, he'd use 27, basically, okay? He's great to read, but you have to have patience. So it's important to remember, too, that we are seeing thoughts as things. Most of us think as things as solid, right? But remember, there's no such thing as solid. There's just that appearance. The same is true with thought, okay? It's energetic, too. That phrase, by the way, that thoughts are things, probably goes all the way back to Napoleon Hill, who wrote the amazing little paperback, Think and Grow Rich. I can't remember if it's 13 or 18 steps that Hill prescribes in that book, but I'm telling you what, if you can do those things, you'll have life by the tail, okay? You will, because he's got it figured out. Now, we might be thinking this is all really esoteric, and it is. Ernest Holmes even makes a comment somewhere in his writings to the effect that the only thing that's really tangible here, that we can really say we know this is real, that this is true, and that this is powerful, is the results. So in doing this research, I remembered a copy of a Science of Mind magazine from about 15 years ago. And on the cover was a headline where they did a study about people who exercised and then people who just didn't. And I mean, you know, they did it in their heads, okay, but they didn't really get up and do it. So I went online, I started looking, and I found a YouTube clip that is the result of a study done about exercise. They took a group of people, they broke the group in half. Half of them did the physical exercises every single day, okay? The other half, they were not allowed to exercise physically at all. They were told to follow the exercise regime in their head only. The physical exercisers, at the end of the study, 30% increase in muscle tone. The thinking group, the mental exercises, anybody want to guess? No, I would love to say that it was, okay? 22% increase in muscle tone. Yeah. It's pretty powerful stuff. I love it, okay? Ernest tells us trained thought is more powerful than untrained thought. You ever try to calm your mind down when it's racing? Trained thought. Yeah, have you ever been awake at night? You know, don't you love those little Facebook clips that come up and say it's, you know, it's 1:45 and my brain has just decided to remind me of every mistake I ever made 40 years ago and, you know, the whole nine yards, right? Trained thought, okay? Dr. Joe Dispenza knew this. Somehow he got this. Any of you follow the work of Joe Dispenza? Joe Dispenza is off the freaking chart. And a couple of years ago, I did a class wrapped around the book he wrote called You Are the Placebo. It's about that thick, and it's about 2/3 neuroscience, okay? So it was pretty intense class and a pretty intense book for people to read. What we did in the class was take the core elements and make them tangible, make them understandable for all of us, okay? And it was loads of fun. Would love to come here and do that class sometime if you guys are interested. It's about a six-week class. The story with Joe is this. In 1986, he had just graduated from chiropractic school. He was single. He was good-looking. He was setting up a practice in Palo Alto, California. He was going to have money. He was going to be off the chart good. I mean, probably great at what he did. He was into physical fitness and activity, and he was in a triathlon. The last component of the triathlon was a bicycle ride. As he was being motioned forward by the traffic cop to turn right, the traffic cop did not see a woman in an SUV behind him. She hit Joe on the bike. He went up in the air, and when he hit the pavement and opened his eyes, he saw her vehicle barreling toward him. She had not gotten control of that vehicle. You know, if you ever wondered, do we have angels? Do we have guides? Do we have things around us supporting us and loving us and carrying us through everything? Yes. Something enabled him to grab a hold of the bumper of her vehicle and hang on literally for dear life. But when she slammed on the brakes and stopped the vehicle, the impact jolted him so hard that he broke free and rolled 150 feet. Both medical establishments that he was taken to, both trauma units, every expert that saw him said, "We'll never guarantee that you will walk again. You will have to have a Harrington rod put in your spine." That's basically a steel rod, runs the length of the trashed part, replaces the spine. He thought about it for a little while and said, "I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to have any surgery." And he managed to get two people who must have been really off the chart great friends to allow him to come and stay with him for 90 days. When he arrived at their house, he was in one of those beds where they flip you over every so often to keep you from whatever, bed sores or whatever. Okay. It took him 6 weeks. Now, he had a deep knowledge of the spine, the human body, musculature, all that, the organs and everything. It took him 6 weeks to put together a meditation that lasted 2 hours without losing his attention or getting diverted or getting, you know, succumbing to pain or whatever, okay, falling asleep. 6 weeks to develop a 2-hour meditation that completely rebuilt his spine. At the end of that 6 weeks, he had that meditation down pat. He did it every morning and every night, 2 hours a.m., 2 hours p.m. 4 weeks later, 10 weeks post-accident, he walked. And 2 weeks after that, he went back to work as a chiropractor. And if you've been to one, you know that a lot of what they do is a very physical job. They have to, you know, they're up on top of you, popping you and stuff like that, right? Okay. That was 1986. He spent the rest of his time trying to figure out not how did that happen spiritually. How did it happen physiologically, neurochemically, biologically? What did he do that made his body change, that caused it to rebuild itself? Today he travels the world teaching this. He's phenomenal, okay? Absolutely phenomenal. Trained thought. Yeah. Trained thought. One of the things Ernest Holmes realized very young in life, I guess he was in his early 20s, and he had just encountered the concept of being able to heal through prayer, through thought, through belief. He realized, Ernest, now remember, he was raised by a mom who believed in a very fair universe. What he realized is that if any one of us could do that, every one of us had the capacity to do that. And that's the basis of all of that. It's really amazing. So what happens if we have a negative thought and we want to change that? Ernest tells us, no problem. We erase thought from consciousness by pouring in an opposite thought. This thought meets the other and neutralizes the negative effect of the initial idea. And even a small amount of right thought has the potential to neutralize incorrect thought, what we might call error thinking. Okay, go back to the iceberg analogy. It's as if when we begin to think positively, we are literally embracing that whole top part of consciousness, and then down, down, down beneath the water with powerful, positive, clear, consistent thinking. And we are retraining our brains to do that, so that if we have a negative thought, like I had at the truck driver in front of me this morning, oh no, some has managed to become an obstacle in my path, how dare him, okay, right? You know, and I immediately realized, just that you can turn right here, you'll be fine. Drive over the sidewalk if you have to, but you'll be there in plenty of time, okay? We can go back and we can correct that, okay? And we can not only correct it, but we can, you know, we can think even a higher thought. So, one last concept. Often when people come into a teaching like this and they hear, you know, we create our lives through our thought process, they go, you are crazy. Okay, I did not create my battle axe mother-in-law. I had nothing to do with that dog who eats my shoes and then vomits up all a mess on my bed. Okay, and I definitely didn't create my poverty, my ill health, my backstabbing co-workers. I had nothing to do with any of that stuff. And you're right. Because not very many of us, at least, would create that kind of stuff consciously, right? But again, there's a lot of stuff under the waterline, okay? There's a lot of stuff. If we had hours, I'm closing it in a minute, if we had hours, we could talk about things like, well, what about karma? Is there such a thing as reincarnation? We don't have a dog in that fight in science of mind, but, you know, if that's something that happens, is there a way that that's playing out? Okay? There's tons of stuff. Stephen Levine, he's deceased now, worked with dying families, especially families with children who were terminally ill and dying, or you know, very ill, maybe not terminally, but really critically ill. And he poses the awareness that maybe we come in with a contract. Maybe Carolyn Mace and all her writings is correct, that we are literally setting the stage before we ever get here. Maybe not specifically, you know, with, you know, the specifics, okay, the script and all that, but we know I need to come in and work on this, okay? So maybe we even have, you know, tribe members who are coming in at the same time who are saying, yeah, we'll come in together with you and we'll help you do this and we'll do that and we'll all get this one big blessing out of it, you know, as our souls advance on this process. I can't tell you I know that for sure, okay? But we're creating from sometimes below the waterline. Yeah. One last thing to think about is, you know, if all that stuff is going on in our lives and we don't have an understanding of how we might have created something or what, you know, what it is we need to do to move it, it's really easy to blame. It's really easy to say, it's my neighbor's fault, it's my spouse's fault, my parents did it to me, it's God's fault. Well, my favorite quote, my absolute favorite quote, something that healed eons of garbage that I was walking around with the first time I read it from the Science of Mind text in the beginning. To suppose that the creative intelligence of the universe would create man in bondage and leave him bound would be to dishonor the creative power that we call God. Whatever it is not a mentally unbalanced dictator. It's a wellspring of love. So the more that we attend to our thinking, the more that we lift our thoughts up into consciousness and then to an even higher peak, the more progress we make in seeing lives that unfold from a place of joy and health and connection and abundance and all the things, you know, even if we think we don't want them or we're not worthy or whatever, I know there isn't a parent alive who doesn't want to see those things for their kids, their grandkids, the people they love, and so on. It's important for us. I believe it's important for every one of us here, for everyone out there, and for this whole planetary thing. I believe that this is our way to choose a different path that will be a healing and a holding for everyone here. I love you. Change your thinking. Change your life. Thanks. And I'm now unplugged.